This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. Night School on BFM 89.9.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts to best understand how society works. Each week, Fuad or I will lead a discussion on a concept or a classic text we hope will shed light on the world around you. So this week, you're going to be talking about the Marxist notion of religion and that famous phrase, religion as the opium of the people, of the masses.
I feel like there's a lot of clarifications that need to be made about what this phrase means. And the reception is always always negative because people think that Marx is insulting religion. He's actually saying a bit more than that.
First of all, where does this appear, and what do we know of Marx? And because I mean we're talking about Marx as if he was a neighbor. He's not.
You know, okay.
Karl Marx lived in the 19th century. I guess we need to say something about his location. For those of you who haven't picked up the latest copy, the hottest bestseller by Karl Marx, you might need this introduction.
Well, Karl Marx is known as a famous theoretician of communism. And I know communism is very passé now after the fall of Soviet Union, but recently, since the economic collapse of 2008, Marx has resurfaced increasingly in debates about economics because people are starting to see that there is a problem with the neoliberal framework, which Marx criticized almost 200 years ago.
But he's a philosopher, not an economist as such.
Correct. So his training originally was in philosophy. But back then, the distinction in philosophy and economics wasn't that cut and dry. Adam Smith was a philosopher as well. He wrote Theory of Moral Sentiments before he wrote The Wealth of Nations. Likewise, Marx wrote a lot of philosophy before he went on to write more economic theory. In fact, the phrase, the opium of the people, was written in a philosophical work. It was in a critique of Hegel's philosophy of right. And Hegel was widely read in German academia at the time. And for Marx's project, he felt that it was important for him to negate Hegel, to write or appropriate Hegel for his own project, which we'll talk about more as we discuss this.
So Marx lived in Germany. Yeah. He was born a Jew, but then his family convert to Christianity?
Yeah, his family was of the generation of German Jews who they were culturally Jewish, but they identified also strongly, in fact, more so with German culture. I think that was the context, the familial context he was in.
So he was taking up the question of the economic system that was developing at that time. I think at this point we look at capitalism as having stages. We're looking at the early part of an industrial capitalism, the development of factories, the division of labor, the assembly line in its maybe in its very early stages of development. Because his big work was Das Kapital, which is an analysis, a three-volume analysis of the capitalist system. But we are talking today about his attitude towards religion. And where does that appear?
Okay, so for Marx, his analysis of capitalism was specifically meant to show that capitalism cannot sustain itself. It is not a system that that will survive for long because there are these inner contradictions that makes it very limited. So a lot of the promises about greater freedoms that capitalism supposedly makes, Marx calls that into question. In fact, believes that it's going to be obsolete very soon because mankind, according to him, will see that it's more destructive than it is productive. And from there, we will try to think of newer economic solutions. So that's sort of the general thrust of his project. But for this to happen, according to Marx, people must realize the problems with capitalism. For this to happen, people must see that capitalism is not sustainable, that it is, in a way, leading us to impending doom. However, the fact that most people do not see this, or the fact that it's very difficult for us to see this because we tend to accept capitalism as a given, means that we have a kind of distorted view of the world. And for Marx, he thought that religion either added to that distorted view of the world or prevents us from wanting to change the world for the better, to change capitalism into a more humane economic system. So religion is this impediment to revolution, in other words. Yeah.
Well, this is kind of odd, right? It's slightly counterintuitive. I mean, you're saying that if a system has problems, surely those who live under it would see it. I mean, it's, you go to a mechanic, your car doesn't work, it's a problem. You notice the car doesn't go from point A to point B. Is it in the nature of the problem that allows a problem to exist without those who are subject to it not to see it?
Marx would say that it is in the nature of capitalism that we are somehow blinded from its problems. Because capitalism isn't just an economic system, right? It has values assumed in it. It has values of freedom, of personal choice, of individual autonomy, right? So when people argue that capitalism is a good economic system, they point to those values. And for Marx, if one takes these values at face value, we'll become more, and especially as we're socialized into the system, we become less and less inclined to see it as a problem. I mean, we see it every day. I mean, just the plain fact is that capitalism is destructive to nature, right? Our basic consumption of the everyday things we use, from whether it's our clothes or the technology we consume, requires the very, very brutal exploitation of nature. This goes on with the knowledge of everybody. But we still somehow just carry on with life accepting it.
I would disagree. I mean, I don't know if it carries on with the knowledge of everybody, because I'm sitting in Kuala Lumpur, sitting in Petaling Jaya. You know, I go out and buy my shirt. I don't know if the shirt was, made by, some workers in sweatshops in Bangladesh. It's not advertised, with the shirt. So I see the label. It doesn't say, sorry, this came from a sweatshop and people were exploited.
Yeah.
Or I buy nice carpets. It's, oh, sorry, 10-year-olds with nimble fingers put this carpet together, right? Or even, in fact, if you see some credit cards, they sell their products, they sell their services by saying, hey, spend more, and a nice little percentage goes to saving the planet. Mm-hmm. So your consumption can be green. So, I mean, with all that, it's very easy not to believe, not to see that in the problems that you so assiduously point out.
Perhaps in those examples, you have a point. But I think there are more everyday common experiences that shows problems that we somehow have not done enough as a community or a global community to do something about. For example, air pollution, right? We just somehow live with it. And China is a good example. I mean, everybody sees it. Perhaps in a case of how corporations channel portions of their profit to corporate social responsibility projects, or where labor behind our clothes come from. These are a bit more clandestine matters, right? But in terms of everyday empirical experience, just going about in the city and breathing dirty air, which we know comes from profit-driven industries, and the fact that we are too pacified to do anything about it shows sort of the numbing factor to capitalism that we just, almost without realizing, succumb ourselves to.
Okay, right. Getting back to Marx and the question of religion,
but
it's central, right? Because it's about how we see. Can we see what is out there without some narratives being produced, constructed for us, a framing of issues? And in an economic system like capitalism, that's been going for hundreds of years now, there's all the other institutional backups to it, whether it's in the media or it's the religious institutions or it's the school or it's the state. All these are also part of the capitalist system and help provide it with the kinds of support systems that sustain it on an ideological level, not necessarily on a kind of economic level. And that's probably where the Marxist critique of religion comes in.
Exactly. So religion has a lot to do with our submission to the capitalist order, at least according to Marx. In fact, capitalism encourages the need for religion. I mean, that's another angle that Marx adds into his theory. And all this contributes to this concept that he has called false consciousness, right? This idea that we have, in fact, we accept a very erroneous and inaccurate picture of the world. And religion is deeply tied to that.
Well, you know, we look at history, we also notice movements, religious movements that were radical, that sought to overthrow the system. And we think of the Anabaptist movement, mm-hmm. The fight for equality within some strains of the Catholic Church, or even the movement of Protestantism. There are many things where if you look at religious history, and you see radicalism, right?
Sure, even recently in liberation theology, that's another example as well.
Right, and many people in fighting colonialism have used religion as a rallying call against, imperialism. Mm-hmm. So are we talking about specific religious institutions? Are we talking about, or is Marx talking about religion as a whole?
He is talking about the human need for religious faith. And of course, he's talking about the Christian, Western Christian context. But on those examples that you mentioned, I think the Marxist answer would be to show that, yes, there are many religious movements who have committed themselves to fighting injustice in the world, so on and so forth. But where they would differ with Marx's project, and where they would be in some ways more inferior to Marx's project, is that they do not identify capitalism as the main source of the world's destruction. They would say that it's immoral people, they would say it's the devil, they would say that these are people who are evil. They would use different categories based on the outlooks they are committed to. What Marx offers instead is a materialist, more scientific grasp of the problems in the world and the economic system that keeps reproducing these problems. So, of course, one can grant that religion can bring some good. And Marx actually, identifies those. In a way, Marx can be read as being amenable to some of those impulses in religion that does call for a better world. But ultimately, the Marxist response is that falls short of identifying what exactly the problem is. So, yeah.
So you used the term false consciousness. Now, is that a term that Marx coined?
It's a term Engels coined, I think. But it's used in reference to some of Marx's theory.
And who's Engels?
Engels is his famous sidekick.
Sidekick? Like Batman and Robin sidekick.
Yeah, in many ways, because he helped find funding for a lot of Marx's works, and he supported Marx in many ways. Even, I think, there's a famous story about Marx fathering a child out of wedlock and Engels coming to the rescue to Marx and claiming that child is his.
Oh, that's interesting. Engels came from money, didn't he?
He came from money. He even ran a factory. It's an interesting saga. Their friendship is epic in many ways, and there are many books about that. Perhaps that's for another show, but it's a fascinating story. Yeah, Marx's life in general. Yeah, I'll give you a good example of sort of where the religious outlook would fall short. I mean, given that we're in Malaysia, we can use something from our context. The Islamic critique of the fashion industry, right, where they would say that, women are pressured to appear a certain way to suit popular culture standards. They are pressured to adopt sort of Western standards of beauty, so on and so forth. And this is usually the premise people put forth to argue for more covering, like wearing the headscarf, wearing the niqab, so on and so forth, wearing the tudung labuh or whatever, right? It identifies a problem in that there are these erroneous and arbitrary standards of beauty that are being imposed on Muslim women. But its solution doesn't really lead to any notion of emancipation, right? In fact, it kind of isolates women more from society, right? So the Marxian take of it would be something like, well, there is a reason why these standards of beauty are being pushed, and that's because it's profit-seeking. Right, and the goal would not just to be to withdraw women from public life, but to identify the system that compels people to put profits ahead of decency, and to change that. Right, so there are overlaps. Religion can identify problems, right, but because its worldview is incomplete, because its understanding of society is distorted, it falls short of finding a proper response to the problems it wants to identify.
Now, this is Marx or you?
Well, this is the Marxist framework. Apply it for the Malaysian context.
Yeah. Okay.
So we're gonna, just to give an example, yep.
Well, coming up, we're going to be talking about that famous phrase by Karl Marx that religion is the opiate of the masses. You're listening to Night School with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and myself, Sharad Kutin, on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is Night School. I'm Sharad Kutin with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and we're talking about that famous phrase that religion is the opiate of the masses. Fuad, you're going to actually read from the text of where this phrase came from and help us make sense of it.
Sure. Yeah, why don't we situate that sentence in the text in which it came from, and we have a better sense of what Marx is trying to say. So the famous two paragraphs reads as follows. Religious suffering is, at one and the same time, the expression of real suffering and a protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opium of the people. The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is the demand for their real happiness. To call on them to give up their illusions about their condition is to call on them to give up a condition that requires illusions. The criticism of religion is therefore, in embryo, the criticism of that veil of tears of which religion is the halo.
Nice. Mm-hmm. So religion is really symptomatic of another problem, mm-hmm. and that this veil he talks about is not just a religious veil, it's a veil that masks or intercedes between the relationship of people and their lived reality.
Correct.
Or the structures underscoring their lived reality.
Correct.
And so what is the name he gives to that veil?
False consciousness.
Yeah. False consciousness. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, some people, and I think people like Isaiah Berlin, when we did that first episode, would be extremely critical of the notion of false consciousness, because it assumes that people are infinitely manipulable, and also that they are a class of people who are beyond manipulation, and he can see the false consciousness, even though the vast majority don't. And
correct.
You're right, and that would be a kind of Berlin-esque
critique. Because fundamentally, false consciousness assumes that one is not fully aware of the motivations behind one's choices. But there are reasons for this, and I think I'm going to just spell it out in simple terms so that we see what's behind Marx's critique here. So Marx talks about man in a capitalist, or the human person in a capitalist society, as one ridden in contradictions, right? So a capitalist society promises us a lot. It promises that effort will be rewarded. It promises wealth for anyone who tries to pursue it. It promises freedom. It promises autonomy. It promises abundance and life of flourishing.
And this is in the afterlife?
No, in this life, in capitalist world, right? Capitalist virtues, yeah. But we nonetheless, despite being faced with these promises, live in a world of scarcity. There are a lot of uncertainties that we go through. Despite having a steady job or a steady career, many of us live paycheck to paycheck. Many of us have to compete even with friends at work just to get to the next stage of our career, so on and so forth. So there's this contradiction between the promises of a capitalist world and the reality that we nonetheless live in. So what this shows is essentially that the human person in a capitalist world lives in insecurity, lives in precarious circumstances. And it is this precarious circumstance that the tendency to seek something, to seek a panacea, to seek a kind of crutch, for lack of a better word, to survive, begins to breed. And this is where religion, this need for religion, fits in well with this condition of insecurity.
Okay, what about, because of course, religion is a phenomenon much older than capitalism. You know, it's actually with us from the dawn of time, from the etchings on the caves that we have in Lascaux, in many places. People have sought, the human creature has sought to express something that looks like what we would call a religion, you know, to deal with the question of meaning. You know, what does existence mean?
Mm-hmm.
And religion is also in many communities around the world for millennia about expressing solidarity mm-hmm. and community and notions of, you know, the place and the role of individuals in their society, and that makes society possible.
Mm-hmm.
So why should the definition of religion be limited to the form that religion might take during one period of capitalist development?
Marx's critique of religion relates to its use or abuse in the capitalist system. But the impulse that he identifies in religion, one would say, has a longer history than that, right? And this, to put it simply, is that religion feeds the insecure soul or the insecure person. And this is, I think, something that one can say is a constant theme throughout human history, right? Human beings, their sustenance is uncertain, will yearn for certainty in being exposed and being vulnerable to chance, will yearn for order and consistency. And in that, what we can see through history is that human beings turn to myths as a way to explain their condition, as a way to justify their limitations and their weaknesses. And some of those myths have manifested to some of the major religions that have survived until today. So the Marxist picture of religion is essentially that. It's of material scarcity, of insecurity, in searching the means of survival. And in that, it forgets that religion is really a creation of man rather than the other way around.
Now, I wanted to ask, you know...
And it's in that because we don't see that, that we do not see the capitalist problem, right?
Say, for instance, Marx lived in our time. Would he look at religion in the same way? Would he actually perhaps have spent more time, say, on the media and, you know, come out and said, well, the media is the opiate of the masses? Is it kind of interchangeable that in his time, religion had that dominant status that in shaping people's view of the world,
mm-hmm.
you know, that perhaps now you can claim for at least a good part of the world, the media has that dominance?
That works insofar as the commonality you draw between the media and religion is that it distorts our view of reality. However, what Marx wants to point to is why there is a need for religion in the first place. And he wants to identify the reality that most of us live throughout the history of mankind without the guarantee of survival or sustenance. And this is what he meant when he said that religion is the expression of real suffering and a protest against real suffering. It is in our suffering, in our braving through the uncertainties of the world, that we require something like a religion to tell us that everything will be okay, right? Religion becomes a source for us to comfort ourselves, to tell ourselves that, yes, despite the fact that we may not survive now, we will have an afterlife where there'll be rivers of honey and milk and fruits, endless fruits. It can just pick from trees, you know, you will never go hungry in heaven. It is sort of the need for religion as a way to placate suffering that creates this veil of myth and a distorted view of the world.
Yeah. So religion in contemporary times, in the time of Marx, prevented workers from kind of seizing or understanding their condition,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and therefore and fighting against it and trying to seize, mm-hmm. to seize industry, the means of production, mm-hmm. and whatnot.
And this is not unlike what we see today, right? Why, if you're a person of piety, there is this inclination to just wait until the next life and then be rewarded. Why change the world now, right?
Okay, I like the idea of this, that there is this structure. So mm-hmm. if we take that structure and we transpose it on to socialist politics,
mm-hmm.
communist politics, and in fact, something that you said earlier on, which is that Marx saw that, you know, capitalism would end and that, you know, it would usher in something else because it had these internal contradictions, mm-hmm. or contradictions internal to the system. And mm-hmm. that's, in fact, part of the way one needs to understand where Marx is coming from. from. Mm-hmm. He has a notion of world history. Mm-hmm. He has a notion of how things change, and it's driven by internal contradictions, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. he has this kind of dialectical mm-hmm. Framework. And that framework allows him to project into the future something quite cheery, maybe mm-hmm. not rivers of milk and honey,
yeah.
but a communist utopia, which you know, Marxists have been accused of, that somehow yeah. Marxists also replicate this religious framework. They too, not afterlife, but future.
Yes.
So the future life is one that will bring. So there was a debate, I understand, in Marxist circles about the inevitability mm-hmm. of the revolution, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that's something that perhaps critics of Marxism have noted, that Marxism itself and socialists themselves are not immune to this impulse to create certainty about mm-hmm. the future.
Correct. The difference would be that Marxists would claim that their certainty is based on a materialist and a scientific understanding of society. Because there will be a future time, whether we like it or not. There will be another decade, hopefully. Well, back then, there was not, the threat of a nuclear warfare wasn't impending for Marx. But at least in the dialectical framework is that there is always a time to come. The question here is whether or not we can, given what we know about society, say something about that time to come. Now, it's true that what Marx, the future beyond religion that Marx identifies is in a lot of ways a promise of a lot of great things that in some way religion promises too, at least in terms of sustenance, so the guarantee of sustenance. But rather than in an afterlife, it's in the sort of the imminent life, right? And what Marxists would say is that it is possible because in a capitalist society there is wealth. It's just not redistributed properly.
Now, coming back to the question of the communist movement in Europe in the 19th century mm-hmm. and then into the 20th century, and its dialogue with religious peoples, mm-hmm. Predominantly the Christians of Europe. Now, what was going on? One often thinks of communists as being sworn enemies of religion, and mm-hmm. it's often been used against communists that, you know, once they come to power, they will destroy churches and they mm-hmm. they would stop people from worshipping.
And they did in the Soviet Union.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of interesting because here is, you know, the idea seems to be that once you actually alter the economic conditions, people would naturally, disavow mm-hmm. religion. Mm-hmm. One did not actually have to, by fiat, by state power, stop people from worshipping. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to reflect on that politics, I mean, if you give some time to that, why was it in the Soviet Union that it was necessary to actually force people to give up their religions, you know, suppress the churches?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are several justifications to this. The first is that the Soviet Union wasn't a developed capitalist economy. And Marx had a very particular and specific view of capitalism from which he projected this sort of socialist future. It did not include Russia. So Russia was, in many ways, a feudal peasant backwater. It wasn't a very sophisticated modern society like France, Germany, or England were. So it could not meet the conditions of, for lack of a better word, enlightenment that Marx had wanted. And of course, there are geographical problems as well, where centralization, because of the vast landmass that Russia is or was at that time, it required stronger centralized state power. So that was what led to those more draconian and dictatorial policies that were done under the name of communism. I think one saving grace for Marxism, if there can be one, is that capitalism continues to show that it cannot sustain itself. Even Keynesian economists are seeing this, you know, and even some libertarians would concede that there are severe problems to the capitalist mode of production. It's a question of whether or not we still need Marx as a solution, but at least as a source for diagnosis. It's very hard to disagree with him. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's hard for you to disagree with him. No, I want to come back to the specific question of religion.
Yeah.
At this time, is it possible for Marxists and socialists to think of people of faith, of religious people, as partners in a dialogue about the economy, mm-hmm. about the problems of economic life as they impinge on society, on living ethically, and you know, and broadening the question of ethics to include sustainability, mm-hmm. environmental sustainability. Is it possible for those who hold to this critique of religion from a particular time mm-hmm. To now say, well, actually, religious people and we perhaps have more in common than we have, that is not in common?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think after the fall of Soviet Union, Marxists have been quite drastically humbled, because they realize that there are limitations to their worldview, that they have to include other perspectives in their project of building a better world. And I think there's more openness in Marxist circles to engage with gender theorists, feminist theorists, race theorists, and even people of progressive religion who see that capitalism is a problem, who see that something must be done to change things before the world continues to degenerate. So there's definitely that now. I mean, Marxist discourse has really broadened to become richer since the early 90s when Soviet Union collapsed.
Okay, we're kind of rounding up this discussion on Marx and the question of religion. I think there's obviously a lot of room for criticality when mm-hmm. it comes to looking at theories developed in the 19th century in mm-hmm. Europe and how it might apply to the contemporary world, especially the world outside of mm-hmm. Europe. Mm-hmm. Some years ago, I actually have a copy of this book in my house, and it's a book called Marxism and Religion by David McClellan, who at the end of the book says that he thinks ultimately, Christianity or religions will trump Marxism, because Marxism has a promise that needs to be kind of delivered in this world mm-hmm. Reasonably soon, whereas Christianity and other religions don't have to deliver, and therefore they can always Marxism can be disproved, yeah. It can fail.
The second coming has to happen in this world though, right?
It does. You're adding nuances into the argument that I don't think he anticipated. But yes, it's a very interesting book because it does trace the genesis of the Marxist critique of religion mm-hmm. and also in real practical terms how Marxists and socialists engage with religious mm-hmm. people and to try to form, to develop forms of solidarity with them mm-hmm. in their fight against the capitalist system. Mm-hmm. We can put more on to our Facebook page, which is BFM Night School, and you can email us at
bfmnightschool@gmail.com.
I'm available on Twitter at Sharad Kutin. Fuad isn't.
Not yet. Yeah.
Not yet. Don't make promises you can't deliver, Fuad. You don't want to deliver. But as you know, we are repeated on Wednesdays at 9 p.m. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Sharad Kutin with Ahmad Fuad Ramat. This is BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.